It is 12 o'clock and you're tuned in to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison, Wisconsin. Streaming and in the archives at wrtfm.org. Once again, thank you from your host Spin Cycle for this past 3 hours of Hegira. Stay tuned for BBC to be followed by A Public Affair.
Govinda Gill with the BBC News. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, says global trade uncertainty spinning out from Donald Trump's tariffs is off the charts. Her warnings of a downturn echo those of the head of the US Central Bank, Jerome Powell. Ms. Georgieva said economic growth would suffer.
Ultimately, trade is like water. When countries put an obstacle in the form of tariff and non-tariff barriers, the flow diverts. Some sectors in some countries may be flooded by cheap imports. Others may see shortages. Our new growth projections will include notable markdowns, but not recession.
President Trump has said he's 100% sure the US will reach a trade deal with the European Union. He was speaking after welcoming Italy's prime minister to the White House. Giorgia Meloni is positioning herself as a key mediator between Washington and Europe. Ukraine's president has accused the US envoy Steve Witkoff of spreading Russian narratives during peace talks. Volodymyr Zelensky was commenting on remarks the American diplomat had made at a meeting with Vladimir Putin in Moscow earlier this week.
I think that Mr. Witkoff has taken the strategy of the Russian side. I think that it's really dangerous because consciously or unconsciously, I don't know, he is disseminating Russian narratives. In any case, it is not helping. And I don't see his mandate to discuss Ukrainian territories because the territories are ours.
The U.S. envoy and the U.S. Secretary of State have been holding further negotiations in Paris today with Ukraine's European allies. Medics in Sudan says the city of El Fasher has been transformed into a prison and place of mass killing after days of violence in the Darfur region. Medical groups and volunteers say more than 50 civilians have been killed in the most recent clashes between the Sudanese army and the RSF. Our Africa regional editor, Camilla Mills, reports.
The deputy commander of the RSF have said that they are hoping to actually take El Fasher soon. Now, this is hugely significant because this is the army's last main stronghold within the area. In the last 6 days, under a week, we've seen 400,000 people displaced from the largest refugee camp in the area, that's Zamzam. And now medics are starting to call El Fasher a prison. They say it's a place of mass killing. We're hearing reports of systematic rape. We're hearing of women and girls being abducted. As it stands, they're saying that there is no safe place, that homes, hospitals, mosques and even schools have become targets from the RSF.
World News from the BBC. Gaza's Hamas-run civil defence agency says Israeli airstrikes across the territory have killed at least 40 people. Most were living in camps for displaced Palestinians. Israel says it resumed its military offensive against Hamas a month ago to force Hamas into releasing the remaining hostages. The US and Somalia have carried out airstrikes on al-Shabaab militants in a battle for a strategic town north of the capital, Mogadishu. Somalia says 12 Islamist fighters were killed in Adan Yabal, including senior leaders. The group, which controls large parts of southern and central Somalia, have been fighting the government for nearly 20 years. The energy giant BP has faced a significant shareholder revolt at its annual general meeting, with nearly a quarter of votes going against the re-election of its chairman. The appointment is normally seen as a formality, but there's been growing backlash against BP's renewed focus on fossil fuels. The French President Emmanuel Macron says he will set up a commission to study the impact of the huge debt imposed on Haiti in exchange for independence 200 years ago. Mr. Macron said the panel of French and Haitian historians would make recommendations to help build a more peaceful future for Haiti. Warren Bull reports.
In 1804, a revolt by self-liberated slaves in the French colony of Saint-Domingue achieved independence. 2 decades later, on April the 17th, 1825, King Charles X said he would end the French economic and political isolation of the new state of Haiti in return for reparations. Haiti's leaders accepted, but the debt of 150 million gold francs, equivalent to about $20 billion now, left Haiti one of the poorest and most unstable countries in the Americas. 2 centuries on, the commission will consider how to find a way out of that legacy of chaos.
That's the latest BBC News.
Literacy Network invites you to join them as they celebrate adults reaching their goals through free adult literacy education at their annual Reading Between the Lines fundraiser. From 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, April 24th at the Black Business Hub, you can enjoy wine tasting, hors d'oeuvres from student-owned restaurants, live mariachi, and a program that features stories from Literacy Network students and supporters, including community leader Joanne Burrish telling her own immigrant story. All proceeds benefit Literacy Network students working toward their dreams and goals, including becoming U.S. citizens, earning their GEDs, securing job opportunities, and more. Registration information for this event is available at litnetwork.org/RBTW2025. Deadline to register is Sunday, April 20th.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation.
And good afternoon and welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. Aimed primarily at China, Donald Trump's trade war tariff regime is but one part of a much larger political and strategic project that could very well lead to a downward economic spiral with immense political and social repercussions worldwide, and quite imaginably open conflict between the world's contending superpowers. Joining us to provide some broader context and explore various implications, international and domestic, of Trump's policy is Van Jackson, an international relations specialist on U.S. foreign policy and practice in East Asia. Currently a senior lecturer in international relations at Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand, Jackson's research broadly focuses on class dimensions of geopolitics. He's the author of dozens of journal articles, book chapters, and public reports, as well as 5 books, the most recent among them, The Rival of Peril: How Great Power Competition Threatens Peace and Weakens Democracy. His articles and columns have also appeared in an array of popular periodicals and electronic platforms. Welcome to WORT, Van Jackson.
Having me.
Van Jackson, in a piece titled Why Oligarchs Want a Recession that appeared in Labor Notes on April 7th, you stated that a recession was looming. Donald Trump, the week before, had sent global stock markets reeling with the unveiling of his global tariff regime. Van, in your piece, you asked why it was, how could it be, that the chief executives of innumerable major firms occupying the commanding heights of the economy remained quite quiet cheerleaders for Trump while he implemented an economic vision that no sane person would endorse. Van Jackson, what are some of the factors that gave these executives of such firms reason to celebrate?
Yeah, so this was the trouble. Like,
we saw from day one of Trump's presidency, but also in the Heritage Project 2025 plan that had been fed to him, that he like disavowed, but then totally embraced, and nobody believed that he disavowed it. In that plan, and in every like executive order and all the legislation on the Hill that has been drafted since he came to power, everything was in the direction of tanking the economy, imposing austerity, laying off, furloughing hundreds of thousands of federal workers, right? Like squeezing Americans, squeezing the working class, and giving up to $4.5 trillion of tax breaks to oligarchs, to CEOs, to the upper crust of society. And you look at that and you're like, well, he's clearly going to tank the economy. And then on top of that is this global tariff regime, which we can talk about, which is directly a tax on consumers. Like it's inflating the cost of goods that people need to live, you know? And so you see all of that. And then one more thing, the immigration ban, right? Which contributes to a labor shock in agriculture. Right, which further, and last time I checked, everybody needs to eat food. So in inflation and food prices, also squeezing people. So like workers are getting hit coming and going. And then the richest of society and the business class, the Wall Street class, they're kind of they weren't saying much at all. If anything, they were giving a favorable view of Trump. And I saw this survey. That was a nationwide survey of American CEOs, and it was done, I think, in February, so before the tariffs, but after a lot of the vision of Trump's economic plans had been established. And I'm looking at everything being like, okay, we're headed toward a Great Depression, and it's pretty obvious, and it seems deliberate. How could this be? The CEO survey, the respondents, said that they had the highest confidence in the U.S. economy that they've had in 3 years. And I'm like, what? And so I started thinking about who the billionaire class was. When you look back at Trump's inauguration, who's on that stage, right? Who are the most prominent boosters of MAGA within the billionaire class? And you start to see like, oh, it's Elon Musk, it's Mark Andreessen, it's Peter Thiel, you know, these are people who, David Sachs, these are people who don't need a healthy economy in order to keep getting richer. And that says something about the section of capital that supports Trump and that is the reason he's in power, because MAGA is a coalition of ethno-nationalists and oligarchs, it's my shorthand to refer to these guys. It's like people who are so rich that it distorts their political power, and like they get political power from being rich, you know? And so these guys, they just are on a different wavelength. Like they are detached from the common good. And so this section of capital, the MAGA section of capital, just doesn't accumulate wealth in the like Andrew Carnegie way. I mean, they're not making things. They're not, you know, producing steel or like creating public infrastructure. They get richer through a mix of speculation, which is like effectively gambling, which is kind of what VCs do, predatory private equity, and then, you know, welfare from the national security state and corporate welfare, right? Which is what tax credits and subsidies and tax breaks are. And so those things don't have anything to do with the productivity of society or the economic security of workers. And so workers, as ever, they need a healthy, buoyant, growing economy in order to demand better wages from the bosses, in order to be able to even just have a job to go to. But that's just not the case for the MAGA section of capital. And so what I'm saying is like, there is a kind of great divergence. Like there is an antagonism between the class interests of workers and the billionaires. And maybe that was always true to a degree, but now it's really in your face. It's stark that we're in conflict.
Let's go back to the tariffs. That is, from a class perspective, what role do tariffs play?
It's a good question. So there's, if you, it depends on who you want to benefit from the, or like what point of view you take. So if you're thinking about this from the majority perspective, from the working class perspective, wage workers, which is most of us, tariffs can be useful in order to strategically grow a specific industry and to kind of insulate it from the ruthless competition of capitalism. If you have some plan to actually grow that sector or that industry, you know, so the one of the most common uses and one of the most legitimate uses is to protect an auto industry. And that's one of the reasons why, like, you know, UAW's President Sean Fain, he's in support of auto tariffs, right? And in the Biden administration, green EV tariffs. And so you see, like, there can be a legitimate use for these things to grow an industry, or on behalf of workers, to send a signal to the markets that, like, if you are an exporting nation, you're going to be penalized if your comparative advantage is labor exploitation. You know, like, if you're doing human rights violations in order to get the cheapest product to be competitive, to therefore export more, if that's the basis of advantage, you should be penalized for that. And so you can use tariffs as a kind of like a labor dumping, social dumping signal to markets, right? Or to exporters. And then you can also use the same thing. They've called them green tariffs, where it's like you impose tariffs on economies, exporters who are using tariffs, but their advantage is not labor exploitation, it's environmental exploitation, right? Excessively lax standards when it comes to environmental protection. So if they're choking and squeezing Mother Earth in order to get that, you know, slightly cheaper widget out the door, that should be penalized as well, right? So you can have these sort of social political reasons for imposing tariffs that are strategic. So green tariffs or social dumping tariffs, or you can try to protect an infant industry. This is what a lot of the East Asian governments did in the 60s, 70s, 80s, right? But it's a totally different situation to adopt tariffs across the board, right? That's just 1930s nonsense. And it's totally a different situation for the world's dominant power, the hegemon, to be imposing tariffs. We can talk about that if you want, but like we're not in the global south. Like, we're not a developing economy. We dominate the highest parts of the value chain in the world's in the capitalist world system. So like the idea that we're putting tariffs on is kind of bananas.
These excuse me. These extreme concentrations of wealth accumulation from the non-productive market, right, have a huge impact. Talk about that. That is, the government under Trump, Vance, and Musk makes the state work almost exclusively for the interests of the wealthy classes. Talk about crony capitalism, American style.
Yeah, it's the American way, I guess. So there's a study that came out recently about specifically Trump's crony capitalism, which is where the owners of businesses, their profits are inflated, or they come entirely from a political relationship with people who hold state power, right? And so in the Trump version of that, like, this study showed that during the first term of Trump, people who were connected and firms who were connected to his businesses generated abnormal above market returns. And there's actual like numbers. I think it was like 3.7% over a 21-day period or something. But like the conclusion of the study was that these politically connected firms outperformed their competitors because they got more government contracts and they were less subject to unfavorable regulations. And so this is one of the ways that the CEO class gets bought off, you know, like the state gives them a favorable regulatory environment. They support labor suppression, the paralyzing of the National Labor Relations Board, strike breaking, you know, union busting. And to have the state on the side of the bosses when it comes to labor relations is extremely valuable to the CEO class, you know, to say nothing of the tax subsidies and tax breaks and stuff. So Trump is a kind of crony capitalist, and that actually ties, I didn't mention this in that Labor Notes piece, but one of the reasons for this global tariff regime in the first place, I'm not the first one to observe this, but Trump wanted to create a spoils system, and a global tariffs regime empowers him to do that. And so a spoils system is a vehicle for crony capitalism. Like, how do you use state power corruptly? How do you use it to benefit your friends and to punish your enemies, right? To put it very simply. And the answer to that, or one answer to that, because there's many, is to set up this tariff wall, because that literally gives you the power to say who's exempt. And so you have concentrated, it's one of several vehicles to concentrate power in your hands, and then you can use that to punish those you don't like and leave the tariffs on for them or increase them even more, or to give them a dispensation as a little reward for loyalty, political loyalty, right? So that's kind of where we're at. Like, that's Trump's crony capitalism. The tariffs are part of a larger MAGA vision for reordering things, but the desire to create a spoils system for Trump, the man, is part of that.
For excuse me once again, for our listeners not acquainted, what is a spoils system? When you talk about spoils,
yeah,
that old 19th century concept that was reformed away by agencies. Reform agencies that were federalized that are now being dismantled.
Yeah, so people are probably familiar with the phrase, like, to the victor goes the spoils, you know. And so it's the idea that your guy, in this case, wins, your politician wins, and he uses his control of state power, which is what he got through election, in order to literally reward friends and punish enemies. And so the rewarding comes in the form, I mean, I guess it could be symbolic, but it's a material thing. It's an economic thing. Like, the reward is increasing their bottom line, increasing their profits, giving them more money, making the market environment and the social environment more friendly to their business interests. So you use state power and the rules, the ability to make rules and laws, you just put it to work for them. And I think that's what most people feel about the economy generally. It's just increasingly flagrant. It's in your face now, you know? Like, they're stealing from us. They're stealing from you. And it's almost like they're not even ashamed of it anymore. Like, they're going as hard and as fast as they can. And so the spoils system is part of that. I mean, like, it's describing this arrangement by which people with political power do the friends enemies thing with state power, even though state power is supposed to be used for the common good, which is just totally lost now.
You're listening to Van Jackson, currently a senior lecturer in international relations at Victoria University in Wellington, New Zealand. Through the wonders of this technology, you're on the other side of the globe, and we're talking here. It's quite something. I could see you even. We'll open up the phone lines at right at the half hour at 608-256-2416. 2001. If you want to join our conversation with a comment and observation, again, give us a call at 608-256-2001. Van Jackson, talk about what you referred to in this piece as Trump's zombie economic nationalism.
Yeah, so the what I was trying to get at, especially in that part of the essay, was like tariffs, as we discussed, do have some uses that can be strategic or positive, but it totally depends on the context. And you can't just say like, well, tariffs are good, or if we're using tariffs to support a specific industry, then the tariffs are good. It's not that simple. Like, everything depends on context, just like with any tool. And so the tariffs in the Trump case are part of a larger agenda of economic nationalism, and it's economic nationalism that is by and for the billionaire class. And so the zombie economic nationalism, like, you could say that like Bidenomics was attempt at economic nationalism, but it wasn't infused with an ethno-nationalist fervor. Biden didn't do a lot for labor, but he was at least sort of labor friendly, you know, which is not nothing. And the contrast with Trump needs some, there has to be some basis to distinguish it, even though I think in the Biden and the Trump case, we're past neoliberal globalization. Like, we're in the era of mobilizing state power on behalf of capital. And you can only call that economic nationalism. Is it to the benefit of the nation? Not really. But who does benefit from it? And in the case of Bidenomics, it was like the semiconductor manufacturers, and it was U.S. manufacturers of EVs. Those were like the main beneficiaries of Bidenomics, right? In the Trump case, economic nationalism is benefiting crypto bros. It's benefiting the Silicon Valley defense industrial cartel, which is the new defense industrial complex. We can talk about that too. And the venture capital firms that support them, you know, and like, that's kind of crazy. Like, this is an economic nationalism where the nationalism part is just a way of like funneling society's resources upward, you know, like it's redirecting your tax dollars and the power of the state up. You know, if workers are getting anything, it's various forms of repression of free speech, you know. So that's what Trump's economic nationalism is. It's just like this cynical weaponization of the nation, as if it's this understood real thing that happens to be white tech bros and rich people, you know. If that's the context that is serving or being served by tariffs, then tariffs are bad. It doesn't matter if it's targeted toward one industry. It's a tool of this particular form of like oligarchic economic nationalism.
I saw that you had given a talk when you here at Wisconsin back last February, was it, on on the meaning of national interest. Everything is couched, it's masked by this term of we all have the same national interest, and it's sold broadly to through the dominant media as if it's freewheeling, has no basis in class relations.
Yeah. In that talk, I was trying to stress that the national interest, Emmanuel Wallerstein is an old scholar, he used to say this, but when the national interest gets invoked, or even the nation gets invoked, it's always on behalf of projects of the state to increase or use state power. So it's a rhetoric that is a mask for the accumulation or use of state power. And when you think about it like that, it makes you really, first of all, that's not obviously good. Like, it depends, you know, you need further discussion and justification to figure out if what's going on in the national interest is good here. But also, at that point, you have to start asking questions like, well, who's benefiting from this accumulation or use of state power? And at whose expense does state power get accumulated and used? And those questions are everything, because repeatedly it's workers who it is at their expense that state power gets used and mobilized. You know, that's like the new modern American story. FDR was an inversion of that. The Roosevelt, you know, New Deal stuff was an inversion of that. But like, what we've been living through my entire life is people telling me that obvious catastrophes and obvious theft is somehow in the national interest, you know, and like for these MAGA guys and for J.D. Vance and the like national conservative section of the MAGA coalition in particular, the nation, as fuzzy as it is the core object. Like, their whole politics is reducible to that if you take it on its own terms. But you probably don't want to do that, because their conception of the nation is very clearly like a white nationalist social order run by tech billionaires. And it's like, last time I checked, that's not most of us. So that version of the nation is not the nation that I understood growing up. So at best, it's just a fuzzy referent.
You're listening to Van Jackson, international relations scholar and public intellectual activist. 608-256-2001. I want to bring China into this. That is, China is the prime target of this tariff regime and a much broader U.S. foreign policy in the entire Pacific aimed at East Asia and so on. Let's talk about the anti-China consensus, which of course goes back way, way beyond even the first Trump administration. This is nothing new. It takes different forms, shapes, but it's been bipartisan and ongoing since the Chinese Revolution in 1949.
Yeah. The anti-China consensus, this was like a massively disappointing thing about the Biden administration, is that like their entire politics, the whole agenda, even domestic politics, was hung on this misplaced assumption that rivalry with a big bad, a great power other, would be the ticket to the rejuvenation of American democracy. You know, it was a nostalgia-based politics based on, you know, what like neoconservative conceit, you know, and it was a nostalgia based on like a really cherry-picked bad understanding of history. So I have this book that just came out with my co-author, Mike Brennis. It's called The Rivalry Peril. And we wrote that, we started writing it at the beginning of the Biden years, basically because we saw that it wasn't just Biden, like the entire national security state and the whole like apparatus that supports it, you know, the congressional side of the defense industrial complex, the think tanks, where I had spent time in a previous life, the Democratic Party itself even, and then to say nothing of the Republican Party, who is like salivating at the idea of a you know, yellow peril, literally. That coalition, that consensus of elites, and it's really important to stress that these are elites because their whole imagination is just different from normal people. They all are on board with basically doing Cold War liberalism in the 2020s, but with an understanding that Cold War liberalism was not what it was. You know, like they have, and I grew up in this myth making to a certain extent, but like they have a view that the Cold War was this heroic struggle against totalitarianism that produced some unqualified victory for the US. It's not really right, you know? Like they have a view that like were it not for the Soviet Union, we wouldn't have civil rights. That's not real, like fighting the Soviet Union, we wouldn't have civil rights. That's not really true either, right? Like this is all like distorted, cherry-picked understandings of what happened in the Cold War. So when we, my co-author and I saw that they were using a Cold War analogy that was a bad, self-serving, narcissistic Cold War analogy, we were like, oh man, this is a death drive to World War III. They don't even realize how dangerous what they're playing with is. Like the right analogy to the Cold War is a global regime of violence and hierarchy and exclusion that superpower competition unleashed. You know, the Cold War stunted democracy in America and in what was then the Third World, right? It risked the annihilation of the entire planet multiple times, right? Over chest thumping. And it saw the launch of, you know, 60 plus coups, 40 something of which were on the side of autocrats by the US, by the CIA, right? The Cold War killed 14 to 20 million people. We just kind of discount it because they were, it was brown and black folks, you know, disproportionately. So the Cold War was bad, is I guess what we were getting at. And if you're going to replay the Cold War, you're going to replay all the bad stuff, and you're going to force us to learn the hard way that the good stuff wasn't even because of the Cold War dynamics themselves. You know, so like we were trying to explain how like this basically zero sum rivalrous geopolitics, it's a rhetoric and a way of transferring wealth upward. It's a way of suppressing freedoms for people. It's a way of strangling the labor movement, which is what happened. You know, national security policy as such is like kind of bad for the working majority. And in addition to risking things like World War III. And so we needed the book kind of helped us get all that out and like make that case. But yeah, like that's what was going on under Biden. And so it's tenfold under Trump. You know, people don't talk about the China stuff as much under Trump because he's also nuking the economy, and because he's like engaging in extra legal actions in defiance of the judiciary, you know, or we call it fascism or something else. But I mean, it is a nightmare for people who have like a understanding of like civic democracy and electoral democracy and, you know, believe in the Constitution. And so there's too much going on in Trump 2.0 to be paying too much attention to foreign policy. But that's a bit of a unfortunate thing because it's still the case that a lot of this power that Trump is wielding, especially with deportations, right? This is all on the basis of the imperial presidency. Like it's the power, the unchecked power of the national security state itself that empowers Trump to do all this stuff. And that power of the national security state is all hung, even right now, on, it's justified on the basis of the quote-unquote great power competition threat with China. You know, you look at the $1 trillion defense budget that they're touting now, the $1.7 trillion in nuclear modernization over the next 20 years. This stuff is, it's like egregious, it's insane in terms of like the amount of money, but you can't justify that just on the basis of like fighting cartels. You don't need an F-22 or an aircraft carrier to fight a cartel. You don't need nukes to fight a cartel. So this entire apparatus is hung on inflating the China threat. And China, there are ways in which China is problematic, but China is not the threat that the national security state supposes. And it's being sold to us, and as a bipartisan matter, it's being sold to us in order to justify the national security state. And going back to the labor notes piece and why oligarchs want a recession, the American economy is disproportionately reliant still on military Keynesianism. In the book, we expand that to be like national security Keynesianism, but it's like the state spending, state on national security functions and military stuff really distorts the way capitalism works in America. And it's become like kind of the only vehicle through which we even get to have a welfare state. But under Trump, even that is being gutted.
I want to take it back one step. For those, our listeners who might not be familiar, what is Keynesian militarism? What is Keynesianism, first off, and how it became distorted? You know, it's distorted through military spending here in the States.
Yeah, important question. So Keynesianism, John Maynard Keynes, 1930s, you know, we're all facing the Great Depression. And he proposed that a way out of the Great Depression could be counter-cyclical spending by the government, which is basically government stimulus spending. Government spends, prints paper, prints dollars, uses those dollars, throws them out of an airplane or pays people to dig holes or public works or whatever. But the spending by the government on whatever, good uses, bad uses, it pumps money into the economy. It stimulates the economy. It pushes us closer to full employment. You know, and so this idea of using government spending to benefit the economy is, it's just taken as a given now that is true or it works, you know, unless you're Milton Friedman or something. Most people understand this. It's not like wild-eyed or anything. But military Keynesianism, which started during the Cold War for the U.S., is using government spending on the military itself, on the Pentagon, in order to juice the economy. So it's like you're trying to help the economy by passing money to Boeing and Lockheed Martin and the contractors who build ships or missiles or something, or maybe by the employment of, troops or service workers for the military, stuff like that. But it's the idea that, like, you create permanent war economy is a term that has fallen out of fashion for some reason, but Seymour Melman used to use that phrase. And it's the idea that, like, you've built an economy around war making. And this has become naturalized for the U.S. Like, in my lifetime, it's just always been this way, you know? And it wasn't always thus. And it's bad for the economy, like, you know, spending on war preparations is a direct attack on the working class itself in like a number of ways. Like, it creates more inequality.
Talk about you've touched on it, but I want to take it a little bit deeper. That is what you refer to as the hawkish groupthink. I find it interesting that the foreign policy team, the advisors, the national security team around, there's that term again, national security, around Trump, are all hawks. You, in your article, you suggest that conceivably Trump could play a positive role, but he's surrounded by this hawkish groupthink.
Yeah. So occasionally Trump uses... not lately, but when he first came to office, he was using occasionally friendly rhetoric about Xi Jinping, China's leader, or like he would say softer things about China, like, oh, they're very tough or something. And so it almost seemed like he wants to have good relations with China personally or interpersonally with Xi Jinping. But that is not a great source of optimism, because when you look at everyone he's appointed in the administration, every single one of them is a China hawk. And some of them are like wild-eyed China hawks. Like Marco Rubio, his Secretary of State, he's just a neocon. You know, like George W. Bush type neocon, like let's invade Iraq kind of person. And Rubio, he has specifically said over the last few years that like China is like the greatest threat to human civilization in history. You know, like in just the inflation is just through the roof. Elbridge Colby, the number three at the Pentagon that's been nominated, he wants to basically like subordinate every priority in politics, including the welfare state, including civil society's needs, including the working class. He wants to subordinate all of it to winning a war with China over Taiwan, which is an impossible commitment, an impossible feat because of where Taiwan is, which is a few dozen clicks off the coast of China, whereas it's thousands of miles away for us, you know, and China has a formidable military to boot. And that's what he wants. He wants to, and this is like, to get back to the $1 trillion defense budget thing, it's like that has to hang on something. It has to be justified somehow. And it's the China threat that justifies it. And so the it's a den of hawks that support Trump. They're confrontational with China. They do have like disagreements on the margins with each other. And I think nobody actually wants World War III, but they are happy to proceed with decisions that make World War III likely and at a certain point inevitable, you know?
Again, you're listening to Van Jackson. Give us a call at 608-256-2001. If you have an observation, a comment, a question, you're welcome to call. Again, it's 608-256-2001. So, Van Jackson, what is to be done? Talk about some of the your proposed solutions. If we lived in a perfect world, what should be done?
Yeah, that's hard to imagine on some level now. I mean, the thing that we argue in the book that we just had come out was that zero-sum statecraft, essentially, sometimes it might be necessary, but it's a dead end. It cannot be your North Star. And the whole notion that the whole notion of the anti-China consensus, the whole notion that great power competition is the lodestar of foreign policy, well, that is zero-sum statecraft. It presupposes that you just your existence with this other country is zero-sum, competitive, rivalrous. And that needs to be reprogrammed. And like a lot of why, not entirely, but a lot of why we have this rivalry relationship in the first place, these conflicts of interest with China, is because of how we choose to relate to the world. So since at least the 1980s, maybe arguably before, depending on how you count it, the US has had a grand strategy called primacy. And primacy is this pretty predatory way of relating to the world, where you require for your security an extreme imbalance of power in the world favoring you. And what happens when that's your theory of security or whatever is that you end up prioritizing other great powers as the foremost threat to the state. And you insist, as part of this kind of way of relating to the world, this kind of grand strategy, you insist on using force to contain or diminish even hypothetical challenges to your supremacy. And you can see how that probably isn't going to go well, you know? And in the unipolar moment at the end of the Cold War, when we're the last man standing or whatever, and extreme by default, the world's power was concentrated in American hands, in that kind of world, you can do a strategy of primacy and kind of get away with it for a while. It doesn't seem especially, I wouldn't have advised it, but you can get away with it. It's rational. In a world that is now more multipolar, where other countries have a say, where you have other great powers like China who have interests of their own, it is World War III brain to go and try and still do a primacy grand strategy. Like to think that you can defeat a nuclear state on its off its own shores, 6,000 kilometers from us, you know, over something that's not even a conflict between the two of you, but it's about some third party territory, right? That is hubris. That's hubris born of a particular way of relating to the world that the national security state takes for granted, which we call in international relations, we call it primacy. And this is the way of relating to the world that must stop. You can play other games, but primacy is a dead end.
Sarah, our producer, tells me that we do have a caller. Hello, Nancy, you're on the air.
Thank you. I guess I have two questions. First, how does ignoring and even exacerbating global warming, climate change, environmental collapse, whatever you want to call it, play into that? Is that just another part of the hubris? And second, what the actions of individuals, what can we do to try and stop this? Or things like the massive protests and the Tesla takedown stuff, is that even worth doing? And I thank you for listening, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, thank you. Very good questions. The Tesla, first of all, Tesla takedown stuff, that kind of thing is necessary and worthy. So Arundhati Roy is a public intellectual from India, a voice of conscience. She kind of predicted 20 years ago when she saw the war on terror start that like America was going to end up in this kind of fascist, I don't know, it's a loaded term for people, but like fascist regime, basically. Like she saw that this is where America was headed. And for 20 years, she's been arguing that like we need to look strategically at how we consolidate, build, assert power, on how we resist. And she was kind of critical of the way America responded to the invasion of Iraq. She was like, it's heartwarming that millions of people poured out onto the streets to say, this is not our war, we're against this war. But she's like, the ruling class does not care. You know, they are not going to respond to those millions of people in the streets. And what she said is like, what has to be done, like the American tradition of protest has been decoupled from the way protest used to be strategically used by like Gandhi in her version of like when India got independence. She was like, you protest as part of civil disobedience and direct action. So make your protest part of a boycott that squeezes those who benefit from the status quo, you know? And so this is part of what Gandhi did. It wasn't just to say it was nonviolent, it says not much. Like it was actually quite strategic. He was trying to get Indians off of British imperial goods, cut off the empire, right? Say, we don't need this. We're going to deny you our labor. So take down Tesla, I think, is one version of that, but it needs to be multiplied times 1,000. And I think ultimately, this is not going to end until people confront MAGA and confront Trump through a general strike. I think that's the logical, it's unthinkable for Americans these days to be part of a general strike, but that's people power. And only by collectively withdrawing our labor from this system that's dealing us death and stealing our money, only then are the fascists going to stop. It's either that or you go into the mountains, you know? And like, I feel like Americans aren't quite ready for guerrilla warfare, neither am I. So like, let's try withdrawing our labor and civil disobedience, you know?
On the first question that our caller had the environmental question issue.
Yeah.
The question of our time in some sense, certainly.
Yeah, 100%. So the climate crisis, it figures into this in a way because it's the oil interests, fossil fuel interests, who are very cozy with the Trump administration as well. So that's why Trump's all drill, baby, drill. And for Republicans, of course, they've been like climate deniers for my entire lifetime. But the real trouble is that like under Biden, we saw more action on climate than we've seen from a U.S. presidency. And it was real, the tragedy is that it was a drop in the bucket. So Biden's only real solution to the climate crisis was boost the production of American EVs. But that's A, not going to do it. Like, it's a crisis. And the timelines that that works on and the amount of carbon emissions that would be reduced, just it's woefully inadequate. So this climate crisis proceeds, even under the best case scenario. The most ambitious thing we've ever seen wasn't enough. And it doesn't even matter anymore because Trump has cut it all off. So we're now heading toward a world where environmental degradation and the knock-on effects of climate change are going to be distributing pain in the world. And it's going to be distributed unevenly. And so for the oligarchs, this is part of their they have all these various exit plans, network, state, seasteading, colonizing Mars, all this stuff. You know, part of that is they want to exit from the civilization that's going to have to eat it because it hasn't been prepared for the climate change that the billionaires themselves helped create. You know, it's a really, really bleak prognosis, and it's pernicious because climate change itself will not necessarily be blamed for the terrible ills that get visited on the planet. Sometimes it's obvious because you have a drought or something, or sea rises, but a lot of times it's going to manifest in these weird ways where it's it created internal migration problems or leads to civil unrest or you end up straining, having resource wars. There are all these ways where the climate increases human conflict, but where the cause is obscured, or where climate change's role is sort of too in the background for people to pay attention to, you know, but it's there, and we're going to keep paying a price for that if we don't do something about it.
We have just a couple minutes, 3-4 minutes maybe, just 3 minutes left in the hour. How do we wrap this up, Ann Jackson? That is in your article dealing with the anti-Chinese consensus. You listed some things that could be done. I wanted to come back to that. I broached it before, but maybe some parting words for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that we really need is a new detente with China. We had a strategic detente with China from 1979 up roughly through 2016. And during that period, the relationship between the U.S. and China was balanced positive. It was basically cooperative. And that facilitated basically what we call the Asian peace, which is non-war in East Asia and in the Pacific for the better part of 40 years. And Taiwan, China's claims on Taiwan had existed for my whole lifetime, for most of this time, but Taiwan wasn't really under threat when the great powers related to each other in a basically productive, cooperative way. Starting in 2016 or so, great power competition becomes the buzzword of Washington. Rivalry replaces détente. And now, suddenly, even though nothing has changed on paper, Taiwan is more under threat than it's ever been from China. And so the lesson here is that the cooperative or competitive relationships that we have either expand or foreclose on opportunities for a better world. And so if we can forge a more cooperative relationship with China, we can create new possibilities.
Well, Van Jackson, I want to thank you ever so much for sharing your time and your knowledge with us today. You've been listening to Van Jackson, who is a senior lecturer in international relations at Victoria University, Wellington, New Zealand. His recent book is just out just a while ago, The Rivalry Peril, How Great Power Competition Threatens Peace and Weakens Democracy. I want to thank Jack for engineering, Sarah for producing, Ricky out on the phones in the lobby. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. and I'll be speaking with you next week.
Don't take no prisoners. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Don't make donations where you can, I get your dough back. The apathetic bullshit, send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible.
Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics on today's show.
In the Solicitor General's brief that I keep referring to said, no court can provide relief to people once they're taken outside the United States, which would mean that the government could take non-citizens or citizens, rightly or wrongly, dump them in an El Salvador prison, and no one would ever be able to relieve. This is a Stalin-esque gulag that they're trying to create. And again, that's why we said, if the Supreme Court were to allow this, we all should be very, very afraid.
A conversation with renowned legal scholar Erwin Chemerinsky about President Donald Trump and the courts. He is the author of the book, No Democracy Lasts Forever. And then later we'll speak to researcher Chris Beyer about the cuts that are being implemented to medical research. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
Hello, I'm Govinda Gill with the BBC News. The head of the International Monetary Fund has described global trade uncertainty triggered by Donald Trump's tariffs as off the charts. Kristalina Georgieva said economic growth would suffer as a result. Her warnings of a downturn echo those of the head of the US Central Bank, Jerome Powell. He's been the target of a fierce attack by President Trump, as Andy Verity reports.
Donald Trump posted on social media that the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's termination cannot come fast enough, and that he was too late and wrong because he hadn't yet cut interest rates.